You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Streaming today online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today you'll hear a conversation with British author Jane Corey, author of the new best-selling thriller My Husband's Wife. Jane Corey is a writer and journalist and has spent time as the writer-in-residence of a high-security prison for men, an experience that helped inspire her novel My Husband's Wife. This is her debut thriller. Corey runs regular writing workshops and speaks at literary festivals worldwide, including the Women's Fiction Festival in Matera, Italy. She has also worked as a tutor in creative writing at Oxford University. My Husband's Wife has hit bestseller lists on the Sunday Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, and Publishers Weekly. Here is some information about the novel from her publisher. When young lawyer Lily marries Ed, she's determined to make a fresh start, to leave the secrets of the past behind. But then she takes on her first murder case and meets Joe, a convicted murderer whom Lily is strangely drawn to, for whom she will soon be willing to risk almost anything. But Lily is not the only one with secrets. Her next-door neighbor Carla may be only 9, but she already has learned that secrets are powerful things, that they can get her whatever she wants. When Lily finds Carla on her doorstep, 16 years later, a chain of events is set in motion that can end only one way. I began my interview with Jane Corey by asking how she began writing My Husband's Wife, which is published by Pamela Dorman Books. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I think when you start writing a novel, or certainly when I start writing, I don't know what's going to happen at the end when I start writing. And for me, that's the fun of it. It's a bit like navigating your own boat, but not being sure where it's going. Mm-hmm. So to answer your first question, my inspiration was this rather extraordinary job that I took when my first marriage broke up. Until then, I'd been a freelance journalist, working consistently for quite major publications in the UK. And then I found a need to earn some extra money on top of my maintenance. So I saw this job that was advertised for a writer in residence of a high security male prison. And it was offering exactly the amount of money that I needed. Mm-hmm. And I was bringing up my youngest son on my own at the time. And I certainly never saw myself going into a prison until I saw that ad. And in fact, when I applied for it, I didn't really want the job, but I thought I ought to because I was getting a bit worried about how we were going to manage. And when I got an interview, I was terrified. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? You know, what if they offer me the job? And I was particularly frightened when they interviewed me and introduced me to some of the prisoners who were, quite honestly, terrifying. And strangely, more terrifying at the interview than when I actually did the job, but I wasn't to know that then. So I will never forget one of the men that they introduced me to, who was exactly how you might imagine a male prisoner to be. He had this dirty T-shirt. He had a huge paunch on him that made him look about 9 months pregnant. Mm. And he came right up to me, right up to my face. There was hardly maybe an inch or two between us, and said, what are you doing here? Because I was being shown around, and I took a couple of steps backwards, but there was a wall, so I couldn't get much further back. And I said, well, I'm here for a job. And I was rather appalled that they allowed someone to go up to me like that.
Right.
And I did actually wonder if it was part of a test.
Yeah.
To make me wonder. And then when they offered me the job, which was that night, they rang that night, and I had just got my 14-year-old persuaded him to go to bed at about midnight because 14-year-old boys not very easy to bring up, and well, not always anyway. And the phone rang just before that and said that we'd like to offer you the job, and I was so horrified and scared and frightened. So I felt I just had to say yes. And then on that very first day when I went in, my heart was in my boots, and I just thought, well, what's going to happen if they attack me? What's going to happen, and I was really frightened about this, what's going to happen if they track me down? Because it's very easy to find people on the internet. And I was, on my own, only living about 40 minutes away. And a psychologist friend of mine gave me 2 really good pieces of advice. He said, put a pair of your hus- your first husband's Wellington boots, which I still happen to have, I don't know why, in the porch outside. So it looks as though a man is living there, mm-hmm. if they ever did come to the house. And secondly, always keep your distance. So if somebody does come up to you again, as they did at the interview, just say something like, excuse me, but you're invading my personal space. And that was actually very good advice. And in fact, although I never needed to say those words again because it didn't happen to me again, it did make me very aware that that was an important part of it. So when I worked in the prison, I soon became addicted in a way I really hadn't expected. And I found myself very interested in what had brought these men into prison and thinking about their victims and looking at the people that came in and out of the prison, who included quite young female lawyers.
Oh, yeah.
So sometimes I'd have a man in my group who would say, I can't make your lesson, miss. They always called you miss, whatever, you know, whatever your status, because I've got my lawyer coming in. And this was a very big thing because it might mean an appeal was coming up. And that's partly what gave me the idea. It sowed the seed for an idea about a young woman lawyer, my Lily in the book,
right.
who starts off married life in the year 2000. She marries a man she doesn't know very well for reasons that become clearer as the book develops.
Right.
And she is asked on her very first day back for the honeymoon to go and handle the appeal of a man, a murderer in prison, who claims that he's innocent and that he has evidence to support that. So Lily's feelings of fear as she goes into the prison are very much my feelings. But at the same time, I love books that have multi-viewpoint, where you have two narrators and where one is unreliable, where you're not quite sure if they're telling you the truth.
Right.
I love this device. And I played around with it in my head while I was working in the prison. And a child's voice can be a wonderful, unreliable narrator, because a child doesn't always see things as they are, or maybe they do see things as they are that an adult doesn't see. So my other character in the first half of the book is a child who happens to live in the same block of flats as Lily and her new husband. And I don't want to give away the
right,
plot,
right.
but as the book goes on, it deals with the relationship between first and second wives. And I married again a few years after I got divorced, and my first husband did the same. And I actually get on very well with his second wife.
Mm-hmm.
But it did make me think, what would happen if a second wife had to ask a very big favor from a first? And that is a key part to the plot.
Yeah. Oh, now so I'm so interested to know how your first husband's second wife reacted to this book.
Well, I actually don't really talk about them during interviews, but I will just say we all have a very civilized relationship. It's not based on them in any way.
No, of course
but
not.
But if I hadn't had that situation in my life, I'm not sure that I would have thought very hard about the relationship between a first and a second wife. And I actually think it's very nice that a first and second wife can get on.
Yeah,
it's a civilized thing to do, you know.
Yeah.
it's great, I think. But what if the second wife had to ask a big favor?
Mm-hmm.
and that's pivotal to the plot.
Yeah. And then did the beginning that you first wrote end up being the beginning of the book?
It did, actually. It did.
Okay.
I see a book like a film.
Mm-hmm.
It comes across visually in my head. And I could very clearly see this young couple coming back from honeymoon. It made me think of that strange time when you do come back from a honeymoon, although I didn't have one with my second husband because I didn't want to leave my teenage son behind.
Right,
we did suggest he came with us, but he turned it down. so we didn't have a honeymoon. But when you come back from being married, if you're young, it's all still quite strange or quite new.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lily is really dealing with unknown territory on two levels here, a new life, a new marriage, a dark past, which you don't know about to begin with, but which is fed through the book, and this huge job on her very first day where her boss, who's a bit of a bully, but meaning well, says, right, you're going into prison. Big
right.
thing.
Yeah. Now, My Husband's Wife has a mysterious side to it. We've sort of touched on that with suspense and secrets. And you said that you didn't really know how it was going to end, but how much did you know as you began? Did you have any sort of plan as you started?
Well, for me, the characters, if they are strong enough, will tell you where to go. So I knew that halfway through the book, I wanted to leap forward 15 years because I wanted to make the characters grow up. I wanted to make the little girl grow up, and I wanted Lily's life to have changed dramatically halfway through the book.
Right.
And I knew that I wanted an Italian couple in it because I love Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I wanted the characters' pasts to come dribbling out, because when you get to know somebody in ordinary life outside literature, you don't know everything about them to begin with, and their background does come out in bits and pieces, and you can be quite surprised at what friends have gone through in the past.
Right.
And they can be surprised at what you've gone through. And I wanted that to come out, and that, in a way, dictates what's going to happen. And that, for me, is the exciting part. So I can't say that I sat down and structured it from A to Z. I just had an idea that I wanted to carry through about this lawyer, about whether she gets this man off or not, and how much should we believe about these characters. I'm fascinated by the fact that all of us have a mixture of good and bad in us, and mm-hmm. that we all try, most of us try to do the best we can for other people. That's always been important for me. But at the same time, I'm aware of flaws inside myself, and people aren't normally all good or all bad. They're mixtures.
Right.
And that was something that I wanted to bring across with my characters.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about a craft aspect.
Yeah.
Your two narrators, as you have said, are Lily and then this mm-hmm. child, Carla. And mm-hmm. you write Lily in the first person present tense, and you
yes.
write Carla in the third person past mm-hmm. tense.
Yes.
So how
yes.
did you come to that?
It just came to me, and I've never done it before in anything, because I write short stories too, and I just thought, I'm going to try this out, because I was aware with Dual Viewpoint that you've got to make the two characters very different.
Mm-hmm.
You need to help the reader differentiate between the two. And this was one very deliberate technique, if you like, to make them different, that one is in the first and one is in the third. I write my short stories in the present tense. I do a lot of short stories for women's magazines, because you are there in the moment. And I wanted Lily to be there in the moment.
Okay.
And I, as I said, I wanted Carla to be different and for the reader to see her perhaps slightly more at a distance.
Yep, that makes sense.
Just to differentiate between the two.
Okay, great. I wanted to talk a little bit about each of these characters. Do you mind if I read just a quick paragraph from the book?
Please do.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is from Lily, and this is her in sort of initial visit to the prison, as far as I know. And she's talking about a guard. She escorts me through another door, and to my surprise, I find myself in a rather pleasant courtyard garden. There are men in Robin Hood green jogging bottoms and matching tops planting wallflowers. My mother is doing the same in Devon. She told me so on the phone last night. It strikes me that different people from various walks of life might be tending their gardens at precisely this moment all over the world. And I really loved that. And I think part of what I loved was it introduced her to me in this, you know, this attitude toward the situation showed me that she is a curious and open-minded person, which would apply to all different aspects of her life and not just this moment.
Thank you.
Yeah. Did you do that on purpose?
I did. And I'm so glad you like that, because it's one of my favorite passages, because I've often thought about how we do the same things at different times all over the world. You know, how we talk to our parents, if we still have them, or how we garden. I'm not a very good gardener, by the way, but I do love gardening. It's very therapeutic, but things do tend to die on me, which is rather a shame. And I'm one of the things that really struck me at the prison, and I'd never thought about this before, because I'd sort of had a vision of prisoners sewing mailbags, is that there are jobs in prison. It's like a little busy beehive.
Yeah.
It's a world where it is run by the men. They all have jobs. They do the cleaning, they do the cooking, they do the gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I spent last Monday in a women's prison as research for my third book for Penguin, and talked to a woman who was in charge of the prison gardens. And she said to me, woe betide anyone who treads on my plants. But I wanted to bring in Lily's home life. I wanted to show that she is close to her mother,
mm-hmm.
But that there have been issues between them which come out during the book.
Right.
And I wanted to bring across the fact that we are all united through the world, that we all do the same kind of things at different times and in a slightly different way, but that we are all the same.
Now this is, I will get back to Carla too. I want to talk about Carla, but what you're saying reminds me of something else I wanted to ask you, which I liked early on, that you blur the distinctions between the officers and the prisoners in the jail.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the guards look a lot like some of the prisoners in demeanor, you know, and you mentioned, or that the narrative tells us the only difference is they're in different uniforms.
That was
another way of just showing the sort of the blur between categories of people.
Yes. And that's crucial to the plot, because Joe, the criminal who is appealing against his sentence, doesn't look like a prisoner to Lily. He is an intelligent man. He's well-read. He's articulate. He can conduct a very good argument. He tests her before he decides that he's definitely going to hire her as a lawyer.
Right.
And one of my big lessons, big eye-openers when I worked at the prison, was that many of the prisoners did not look anything like that first prisoner at the interview. They did not look like prisoners. They could have been a next-door neighbor. They could have been a friend's husband. And many men were well-educated. And I would talk to them when I got to know them. And, in fact, this came out in their writing. So I would talk to them about what had led to a crime. Now, it's actually not considered good manners to ask someone in a prison what they're in for, and I learned that quite soon.
Yeah.
So you don't do that, but they often tell you, and my job as a writer was to encourage them to write anything, short stories, novels, life stories, and of course in that would often come details of their crimes. And I had men in my groups who were former managing directors, who'd had high-level jobs, and many of them had committed crimes under the influence of drink and drugs.
Mm.
And I would go back and I'd say to my then 14-year-old, please don't ever do either. You know, don't get drunk, you know, too often, because, you know, oh, I can't say don't ever get drunk, but things happen when you're out of control. And it was such an eye-opener. And in fact, I now don't drink at all.
Mm.
I didn't drink very much before anyway, but I don't drink at all.
Yeah.
And it was a huge eye-opener that people actually didn't necessarily look like prisoners. And that the staff, some of them did look like the prisoners. And in fact, I did have to win over some of the staff. Understandably, they probably took a second look at me and thought, you know, what is Mrs. Goody-Goody doing in the prison, you know, helping men write, helping men who had raped, who had murdered, who had destroyed families. You know, why should they write? But in fact, I'd been hired by an organization because research shows that writing can boost your self-esteem, and boosting self-esteem can stop people reoffending in prison, which might sound a bit of a tenuous link, but the statistics show that. And certainly many of the men whom I worked with said, Jane, if I hadn't written that, I might have been thumping somebody's head against a wall. Which to me was probably one of the biggest compliments they could have said, because it meant that they got their anger out in writing. And Christmas is always a very difficult time, and I would leave them for a week or so and say, write yourself into your corner, write your way through Christmas, get your feelings out on paper, because it helps. Mm-hmm. And in fact, now I'm a judge for something called the Kessler Awards, which are given to men and women in prison.
Oh, wow.
And it's fascinating. And every summer, I get about 500 entries from men and women writing their life stories all over the country, and it includes mental institutions as well, people who've committed crimes who are also in mental institutions. And I have to whittle those down with another writer down to 20 mm-hmm. winners, which is a very difficult thing to do. Yeah. But it's just shows, I think, how important it is for people to write. And when I was a writer in residence, I would enter my men for the Kessler, and the people who'd got awards would go around with this amazing beam on their face, and their behavior would improve according to the staff. And it just made them feel different about themselves. And now if that can stop them doing something bad to somebody else in prison, because unfortunately prisoners can hurt others in prison, and if it can help them turn the corner when they go out of prison, then we have done our job. And in fact, I'd like to say about something else I did when I was there, because sure. I had a completely wide remit. I was allowed to do whatever I wanted. I wasn't part of the education class. You know, I was, because I was writer in residence, I had independence, which was lovely. So, but it was a bit daunting to begin with, because I had gone into this prison that was, there hadn't been a writer in residence before. So I started off like a literary Pied Piper and saying, look, I can help you write. And they, some of them would say, well, I physically can't write. So I would say, that's no problem. Tell me your story and I will write it down for you. And I started off with a project called Slices of Life, where I'd get them to write down little funny anecdotes, or it could be sad anecdotes, but there is such a thing as jail humor. You sort of have to laugh at some point because you can't deal with the pressure otherwise. So people would write down funny things too. And I made this little publication called Slice of Life, and I asked the staff to do the same. And that helped bring them together in a way. It helped. They were interested in reading each other's stories. And then I was told when I started work at the prison that many men either find the gym or God. They either get very religious or they get very into the gym. And that kind of preyed on my mind a bit, and I go to church. And I suddenly thought, halfway through my residency, what about something where everybody writes down a saying that gets them through? When I was a journalist on a woman's magazine, I was asked to interview celebrities on sayings that got them through life.
Yeah.
And I thought this might be a way to get men to contribute to an anthology. So I asked the staff again to do this, and I called the book of uncommon prayer. Because we have, so, you know, not the book of common prayer, but the book of uncommon prayer.
Right.
And in fact, it's still being published, and the men were so thrilled to have their work in it that it did change behavior, which was, I think, you know, something I feel I'm glad I did.
Yeah, you must be very, it must be very satisfying to actually not only be there, but be actually making a difference and seeing the outcome of that.
I think the thing is that everyone works towards making a difference. And in a prison, there's so many different people, and the staff are incredible. And there are some wonderful staff in prison. And I don't think that people know how good prison staff can be. So, for example, one man that I had wrote the most wonderful poetry in the most beautiful handwriting. And he said to me, you know, Jane, 7 years ago I couldn't read or write, but a prison officer sat me down and taught me. Now, this is a murderer who will be in for a very long time, scary-looking man, wrote the most beautiful, tender poetry, and a prison officer had taken time to sit down and write that with him, to teach him to write. And that's just amazing.
Yeah.
That prison officer should have a medal.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I try to bring this in to my novel. But the prison is a major part of it, but it's not totally... I mean, there are other things in my husband's life, like art, for example.
Right. Now, let's just take one step back and talk. I had a question for you about Carla. So your other narrative point of view is Carla, and in the beginning of the book, she's a very young girl, and then in the second part of the book, she's a young woman. And at that point, things, I don't want to give anything away. So, but if you can speak around the subject without giving away the plot, I'm wondering how it was for you to develop a character through two separate stages of her life.
Well, I quite often get a lot of my ideas when I'm walking or swimming. We live near the sea, and I'm one of these crazy all-the-year-round swimmers in the sea. And it suddenly came to me when I'd started the book that actually one could do so much by just literally leaping forward 15 years. Because if you think back over your own life, my own life, anyone's life, so much happens in that gap of 15 years. And I wanted to show why a rather calculating young woman is as she is. So I hope that I showed that through a childhood where she learnt how to behave through her mother's example. So if you had been introduced to Carla from the age of 21, 22, you might have thought, well, my goodness, that's a calculating young lady. But because you've known her as a child and you've empathized with her and wanted her to be all right, and you've seen her mother, who was trying her best to bring up her daughter under very difficult circumstances, you then understand why Carla is a calculating young lady.
Right.
And you don't condemn her the way that you might.
Right. There's a line early in her narrative where she says, "Mama was happy," observed Carla, "with a lightness in her own heart." And it's like she's so dependent on her mother's happiness and approval. And she's also lonely. And I see that now, that why you did that. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, I have another craft question for you. I want to talk a little bit about working backstory into fiction. I think it's something that has to be handled sort of carefully so that you don't fill too much backstory in the middle of an active scene. This is just a tiny little micro example, but it sets up my question for me, and it's not too long. Do you mind if I read another little bit?
No, please do. Please
okay. So, again, she's at the prison, and "Sugar, sellotape, crisps, sharp implements," barks the man on the other side of the glass divide. For a moment, I wonder if I've heard right. I'd gone toward the lovely house, relieved that prison wasn't that terrifying after all. But when I got there, someone directed me back across the grounds, past the tin-roofed huts, and toward a high wall with a curled barbed wire on top that I hadn't noticed before. My heart thudding, I walked along until I reached a small door. "Ring," instructed the sign on the door. My breath coming faster, I did so. The door opened automatically, and I found myself in a little room, not that different from the waiting area in a small domestic airport. On one side was a glass partition, which is where I find myself right now. And then we go back to sugar, sellotape, crisps, sharp implements. So this is this wonderful little moment where we're in an active moment, and we're in a scene, and then you just step out for about two paragraphs to say how she got there, and then we're back into it with the same line that we started with. And I thought that was a nice tiny little example of how you include backstory. So can you just talk a little bit about including backstory?
Yes, I think we need backstory because it shows us how our characters tick. But if you spend too long with backstory, then you move the reader out of the zone that you've already brought them into, and that's rather uncomfortable. It's a bit like when you bring a guest into the house, you might get them comfortable in the sitting room and say, "Actually, come into the kitchen," and then you're in the kitchen and say, "Actually, come back to the kitchen sitting room." And you kind of want to keep it short and not sharp, but I don't think personally you should have more than maybe three paragraphs of backstory.
Yeah.
Because if you do, you're asking too much of the reader. And if you do more, then I think you need to section it off with a line gap or stars or something to show that actually you've changed in time.
Right.
I wanted to start off with the sugar, salt, etc. Sorry, with the sugar, because it was a huge eye-opener for me when I worked at the prison that there were certain objects that seemed perfectly innocuous that you weren't allowed to bring in, like sugar. And actually, you're not allowed to bring sugar in because the men can make an alcoholic drink out of it called hooch, which is illegal and can cause all kinds of problems. The crisps was a slight in-joke, it has to be said, because when I'd been working in the prison, probably for about 3 months, two huge burly officers came to my door. I had a little tiny office. And they said, "Can we inspect your bags?" And I said, yes, of course. In fact, when they came to the door, I was very worried. I thought something ghastly had happened at home.
Oh, yeah.
Communication is very difficult. You can't take mobile phones in, and it was all quite complicated. And from a single mother's point of view, it was tricky for me because prison starts early, so I had to try and get my youngest out of bed to go to school, which wasn't easy, and then get to work. So I thought something ghastly had happened. And anyway, they came in and they searched my bags, and I'd bought sandwiches in, and I'd bought a packet of crisps and something else. And they said, we were told you'd brought in several bags of crisps. And I said, no, you know, here's my lunch basket and my book that I'd brought in. And I said, what? Why would that be a problem? They said, well, we thought you were using them to bribe the prisoners. And I said, well, no, not at all. But I phoned the governor and I said, this is ridiculous, blah, blah, blah. And I never had that problem again.
Yeah.
But it was a bit of an in-joke. And I think perhaps understandably the staff might have, as I said earlier, thought, you know, who is this woman? And then one day, when I'd been there for about 6 months, I'd had a particularly difficult evening with my youngest, who wouldn't do his homework. He's a very good boy now, but bringing up teenagers is not terribly easy, especially when you do it on your own. And I was looking pretty tired that morning, but actually, I've got to be very honest, I'd smeared on some concealer under my eye and not checked it properly and looked rather pancakey white. And this woman who, when you signed in, said, oh, you look dreadful. And this woman had normally been a bit sharp with me in the past. And I said, oh, I said, you know, I was trying to get my youngest, my teenager, off to bed last night. And she looked at me and she said, say no more. And from that day onwards, she was so nice to me. So I just think, you know, you need to show your human side sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, And so the crisps were a bit of an in-joke.
So one more thing about the prison setting. I'm wondering, did you have to take great care to keep Joe Thomas, your prisoner, who's in the book, from looking like anyone particular that you had worked with?
Yes, and in fact, interestingly, I was very careful about that, but I contacted my governor, who has since retired, and asked if he'd mind reading the whole book, just so that he could check that by mistake I hadn't portrayed anyone.
Now, when you say governor,
governor is the man in top or in charge of the prison.
Okay.
So there are actually several governors in a prison, but he was the very top man, and I got on very well with him. He was actually a poet as well, very nice man, and he interviewed me for the job along with other men. And in fact, I thought I'd completely messed up the interview, so I was very surprised when I got it. As I said, because he'd asked me this question about what I would do if I was running a writing course in a prison, and a security officer came in and said, write everybody out. So I said, well, I'd get the men to finish in the middle of a sentence so that when they came back, it would be easy to pick up again, because that's the technical trick. And he said to me, by which time half the prison would have escaped. So I thought then, oh, well, I've blown it. And so then I lost all my nerves because I didn't think I'd got the job. And it was all perfectly I was much more natural after that than I got the job. So I asked him if he'd read the whole book, which he did. And he said that in his view, it was absolutely fine and it didn't resemble anyone that he knew, which was a great relief.
That's great. Now, the word governor, I guess in the States we call that the warden. And in your acknowledgments, you mentioned having learned that many words in the UK mean something quite different in America. I thought that was interesting. Yes. Did you have to change anything for your American readers?
Well, I had a wonderful American editor. Pamela Dorman is brilliant, and one of her colleagues, Jeremy Orton, fantastic. And we had a few chuckles about different wording. So, for example, in English, if a character doesn't quite understand something, we might say so-and-so doesn't twig like a leaf, so-and-so doesn't twig, it means so-and-so doesn't get it.
Right.
And I remember there was a query, what does this mean? So I had to explain. and ditto, you know, you say cell phone, we say mobile,
right.
Or you might just say cell. Well, a cell, C-E-L-L in England, is like a prisoner's cell.
Yeah.
So, yes, I mean, it was an intriguing lesson, and I'm also absolutely thrilled that it's being recorded as an audio novel, too, in the States.
Yeah.
And I had some lovely correspondence with people who are doing that over in the States.
And are they using two different actresses to do the voices of the women?
That's I think they're using one, actually. They decided to use one. In England, it's one as well.
Okay.
But it was just wonderful listening to the UK version, because I actually went up to London to see it being done. Wonderful to see that and to hear, really, how the different voice comes across, and also to listen to the different expressions that are used. So when the American edition came through, it was just so exciting seeing it not translated, but in the same story, but put across in a very slightly different way with different words.
It's like a cultural translation.
Yes.
I loved the way you occasionally wove threads of the plot into a moment through language. And you did this a number of times, but here's just one example. At one point, Joe asks if Lily thinks they have a case, and she says, and I've edited this, I don't, it's not the whole thing, but she says, "We might, providing what you're saying checks out. We need to work on this together. Promise?" And then after that in italics, it says, "Promise," said Daniel toward the end. "Promise," I said to Carla when I asked her not to steal again. "Promise," Joe Thomas now says. And I loved that. I thought that was really interesting. Is that something that you've done in other stories?
Yes. Well, it goes back to the backstory of a character and the fact that there's a lot more to anyone that meets the eye. Mm. And I love popping those things in. I tend to do it when I finished the novel, and I go back and I kind of sow the seed. Now, I was always hopeless at science, but one of the things that did intrigue me was when we had this little exercise with pipettes. Do you call them pipettes in the States? They're like little droppers, liquid droppers.
Yeah.
And you drop something in, and I visualize this as dropping a seed of a clue into my novel. So we might often say the same thing, same wording, in a different situation. And I wanted to show there that the word promise held a great significance for Lily, because it went back to, I'm not going to say who Daniel was, but Daniel was an important person in her life.
Yes.
And it went back to Carla too. So the image of the word promise meant different things to her. And often in times of stress, somebody can say something. It can be an innocuous word, a word that means, it doesn't seem terribly significant, but you associate that word with something awful or something good.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, something pretty bad happened to me some years ago, and the person who gave me that news used the word chill in her sentence. And now, if I hear the word chill, it takes me back to that rather bad situation.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be like that for Lily. That words, smells have an enormous association.
Sure.
I think for people, and that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Let's see. I wondered if you could just briefly talk about finding a publisher. This was your debut novel, and although you were a very established author in story writing and journalism, I think it's always hard to find a publisher for a first novel.
Yes, my first psychological suspense. When I wrote it, I didn't know it was a psychological suspense. I just wanted to write about family relationships being stretched to the limit. And I wanted an agent who understood that. So, in fact, I did know of somebody who was a copy editor, so mm-hmm. somebody who edits work. She wasn't my copy editor, but I knew of her. So I rang her and said, you know, really sorry to bother you, but do you know of any particular agents? And she gave me three names, one of whom was the agent who took me on, and who happened to be looking at the time for psychological suspense. So I said, "What's that?" And she said, "It's what you've just written." or in fact, she'd only seen the first three chapters.
Okay.
I, you know, didn't know I was writing the psychological suspense genre. I knew I wanted to write a plot, as I said, that stretched relationships with lots of twists and turns. And then I said to her, "Well, what happens if I finish the book and you don't like it?" And she said, "Don't worry, I think I will, but just write it." So she took me on the strength of those chapters, and I wrote it, and she liked it, and she suggested a couple of tweaks, not very many, and then she sent it out. And it can be a very long business, and I was very aware of this. I knew that all too well. And so,
there were a couple of people that expressed interest, and then somebody took me out to lunch and said, well, I quite like this, but actually, how about writing a book along these sort of lines, and we'd be happy to look at it next time. And then about 3 months after the agent, my lovely agent, took me on, we were packing to go up to London for a family party, and we were running late, and the dog needed a walk, et cetera, et cetera. And my husband was saying, are you sure you need to take all those clothes? And the phone rang, and it was my agent, and she said, Penguin have read your book. This is Penguin UK, and they rather like it. I just thought I'd keep you in the loop. And I said, oh, you know, right, thank you. And I thought, well, I didn't actually think very much of it, that, because I thought, so much, I've sort of been through that before when somebody had liked it and it had come to nothing. And maybe right. It was me not wanting to get my hopes up. And then these phone calls escalated during the day until they got to the point that, actually, they'd like to see you. Is there any chance, if you're coming up to London, can you see them tonight?
Oh, wow.
So I literally met them in the hotel where we were staying before we were going on to this very special diamond wedding party. And I just loved my editor. From the minute I saw her, she knew my characters. She got them. And they made the offer the next day. And they bought world rights, which meant that they were then responsible for selling them to other countries.
Okay.
And I was so thrilled when Penguin Viking bought it in the USA, and I was so thrilled that it was a Pamela Dorman imprint, because from the very beginning they were just so warm and friendly and introducing themselves by email. I mean, I'd love to meet them one day, because it's all been email at the moment, but they're just, I feel as though I know them.
Yeah.
And they've been wonderful. But I do run the odd creative writing class. And I say to my students, one of the best ways to get an agent is to go to literary festivals and try and meet people face to face, and go to festivals where you can get one-to-one feedback on what you're writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do know people who've got deals that way, and enter competitions, not with a view to winning, but because of the discipline. And sometimes the prize can be lunch with a literary agent,
mm-hmm.
which can be a great thing to do, to have, and to network.
Right.
So, and also to look for publishers. Some publishers have what we call, I don't know if you do it in the States, have an open week submission where they will look at people's work without an agent
yes.
agenting it.
Right. Right. They must get so many submissions that week.
They must do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when you did sell the book to Penguin, did you have to do a huge revision, or did they like it as it existed?
There was quite a lot of revision, actually. I later found out this is quite normal. One of the things that happened was that something happens to one of the characters in the published book that didn't happen in my original.
Okay.
And that came as a result of me having a discussion with the editor.
Okay.
And that kind of, you know, what is something, what is this, what if that happened? So most of it is the same, but I think my editor helped me dig deeply into the character. She would go back and say, well, you know, what did this person do beforehand? Why did Lily marry her husband? And it was all there in my head.
Right.
But it was quite a lot of it were in previous drafts that I'd discarded. That often happens with writers, that you discard a draft and then somebody says, well, you know, what about this? And you think, well, I did put that in, but I discarded it. So some of it was putting it back in again. And then it was then edited again by Pamela Dorman.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very interesting, because she threw up some questions that hadn't been thrown up by my UK editors. So that was intriguing too, and I feel I've had quite an education all round, actually. And I'd like to think perhaps we've educated each other, because now there are some Americans who know what twig, or not to twig, means.
Well, having just said that you've learned so much. Now, what are you working on now? You made it sound like you're working on your third novel. So
yes, I am, because I tell you about number two first. I just want really just to pick up where we were talking about being published. When you are published, and I know this from other friends too, that's just the beginning, and you don't know if the book is going to sink or swim.
Yeah.
And it was just so exciting for me that the book became a Sunday Times bestseller. It got to number 5 in the Sunday Times. And and has sold actually 100,000 copies in the
good
UK. For
you.
And then when I was also so excited when America bought it, and then when it was published at the end of January, it got into the Washington Post bestseller list and USA Today and Publishers Weekly.
Fantastic.
And I kind of floated that week. I floated around our little seaside town. It just felt so exciting. But I didn't want to boast about it because that would be wrong. So I just told very close people, and they were sweet enough to mention it to one or two other people. But and I also have some friends who live in the States, so that was lovely. So I was able to tell them, and they could go and take photographs of the book in Barnes and Noble and all the other lovely bookstores that you have out there. But my book, Deal with Penguins, was for two books. So the second book is called Blood Sisters.
Okay.
And it explores that very complicated relationship between sisters and best friends, and it's about best friends, sisters. It's about sisters, lies, loves, best friends, and prison. Prison store features in it. And it comes out in the UK in June, at the end of June, and I'm thrilled to say that America has bought it.
Oh, great.
And so it will be out in the States.
And is it again Pamela Dorman?
It is. And so I'm so thrilled about that. And then, so that's all written. It's all written. And then the third book, I've just got another deal with Penguin, which is very exciting. So I'm just writing the third book. It's that lovely, wonderful stage when you're writing and your head is in that book. And I always write a chapter a morning when I'm writing a book to keep it in my head. And then when I stop writing, it's quite hard to live the rest of the day, to live normal stuff and to do the dusting, do the stuff.
So yes. You write a full chapter in a morning?
I do. It's my journalist background. It's what I do.
Wow. So you must write pretty quickly.
I do, yes. Yeah. Yes. I write about 2,000 words in 2 hours. But I always say to people, it's not the quantity, it's the quality.
Right.
And I was taught at a very early age to write fast, because after my degree, which was in English, I became a journalist, and that's what I did. In fact, I still do a column for the Daily Telegraph once a week on being a grandmother, because I'm a young granny.
Young,
and about the funny things that happen, and I look after my granddaughter 2 days a week now, it is great fun. So I've had to readjust my writing schedule slightly, but I just feel it's a great compliment to be asked to do it, and it forges wonderful relationships.
Oh, that's great. I just have one last question, and then just for my listeners who are writers as well as readers, I wonder if you have advice for keeping suspense going or for building suspense.
I do. And it's really important. And that is to have something happening in each chapter. So when I mean something happening, an event that doesn't necessarily have to change a character's lives, mm-hmm. but just takes the gear change up a bit. And I always visualize it like when you're driving a car and you go to a slightly different level, you change gear. So I always say, make sure you change gear during the chapter so that something happens where the character is maybe put in a quandary, that would be a big change, or something smallish where they're a bit uncertain about something, or they're looking forward to something, or they're dreading something, but something that just shifts that mindset in every chapter. And I also call it upping the ante, A-N-T-I. So if you feel the plot is getting a little bit stale or that is dragging, or you're getting a little bit bored with it yourself, put something in, lob in a firework, make something happen. And it could be something quite mundane, like forgetting, one of the characters forgets somebody's birthday, or it could be something big, like an illness or a letter that arrives, which changes somebody's life,
yeah.
or a phone call. So it could be a life-changing event, or it could just be something that, as I said, introduces that suspense, that tension. And one writing tip is to make a list of all the things in your life that have changed your life, the events that have changed your life. Those would be the biggies. And then look back over your life in the last month and just think of little sort of small changes. So, for example, today I'd ordered a taxi to go from where I was in London to the London railway station to get my train. And you have to have a particular train because I booked it on that ticket. And the taxi didn't turn up. And I was at a writer's lunch due. And a writer's friend, sorry, a writer friend's husband, who's in his 80s, very kindly drove me instead. we did not break any speed limits, I have to say this. But he has the oldest car I've ever seen, sweet little car. I'm amazed it's still allowed on the road. And we scooted in and out of the traffic, and I just got that train by the skin of my teeth. Now, if a character doesn't get a train, if he misses, she misses a train, what might happen as a result? So that could go on your list.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful advice. Thank you. That's great.
Pleasure.
Well, Jane Corey, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me. I want to just mention that the book is My Husband's Wife, a novel by Jane Corey, published by Pamela Dorman Books in the United States. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been really good fun talking to you. Thank you.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And as I just said, that was an interview with best-selling author Jane Corey. Her debut thriller is My Husband's Wife, just published in the United States by Pamela Dorman Books. So this week's Write the Book prompt, it comes from today's interview, generously offered by my guest, Jane Corey. It was something that she mentioned during our conversation. Characters always go through change in the progression of a narrative, or pretty much always. And so to help you relate to the many ways in which a life can change, make a list of the larger events that have changed your life. Perhaps you'll include life cycle events like births and deaths, marriages, but also accidents. Did you ever experience an accident, a fire? Also, something like an inheritance. Think about these larger events that may have changed your life significantly. And then also make a list of the somewhat maybe more daily kinds of things that you might not think about as creating big change that have happened in the last month or even the last week. For example, just like Jane said that her cab never showed up, and so she had the opportunity to ride in this old car with this person who took her instead of the cab. So, for example, if you missed a train, what did that change about your day? Did it impact some larger truth for you? What was the result of that? And how might some similar events, small or large, change the lives of your characters? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. I've mentioned this last week. I'm planning a new Write the Book feature. I would like to present listeners' book suggestions from time to time. So if you've recently read a book and would like to share your thoughts about it on the show, you could email me at writethebook@gmail.com, and we'll see if we can work out a time for me to talk to you about your reactions, hopefully positive reactions, to a book. And that'll become part of a segment on basically book reviews by listeners. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then finally, of course, you can stream the show live each week here at 99.3wbtv.org. Every Monday at 3. A second hour, as you just heard, features reruns, eventually possibly other new content as yet to be designed. So stream the show live, and when we are broadcasting, it'll be on 99.3 FM. We'll be sure to let you know when that happens. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I said earlier, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV-LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.